in this country have spent a lot of time trying to figure out where we stand in the world, both politically and economically and socially. That is, how we fit in to the world order. We like to think that in many ways we're on top, and in some ways we are. But in some important ways, as compared with the other industrial nations of the world, we don't do very well. We'll be looking at some of the ways in which we rank highly and some of the ways in which we fall down this morning in this part of Focus 580. Our guest for the show is Andrew Shapiro, who has written a very interesting book, a book entitled We're Number One. It is, in a sense, a statistical portrait of life in this United States. But that doesn't convey how fascinating it is to go through the book, because it is more than just a collection of statistics and numbers. It is really a portrait of life in the United States. And it also really underscores that in this country there are some areas in which there is a very large gap between what we say and what we do, between our beliefs and our behaviors. This book compares the United States with a number of other industrial countries in areas like politics, the environment, the economy, how we approach health and medical care, our attitudes towards things like marriage, divorce, sex, sports, and a number of areas. And it all comes together to give us something of a portrait of life in America today. The book, We're Number One, is published by Vintage Books, if you would like to take a look at it. And as we talked this morning with Andrew Shapiro, you should certainly feel free to call in. Maybe you'll have some questions or some comments you'd like to respond in various ways to some of the stuff that's in here. We certainly welcome your being involved in the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, the number is 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, you should use that number. And that is 800-222-9455. The numbers are close. They're not exactly the same. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Andrew Shapiro is a staff member of The Nation. He is also a teacher of social studies and English at the Dalton School in New York, and he's talking with us today by telephone. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Surely, David. Thank you for that very nice introduction.
Well, if you will forgive a mundane question to open with, but it seems like a logical place to start. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about how it is you got into this project in the first place and came to collect all of this information.
Sure. It was the end of the Gulf War last year, and I was just starting my work at The Nation magazine. In fact, I was an intern there. And I was, along with the other staff members there, looking at the various, shall we say, collateral fallout here in the United States, the various statements being made by our president and other political leaders, General Schwarzkopf and others. And there seemed to be a resounding ethic or ethos that it was becoming prominent that we were, again, number one, that the United States had somehow in its war in the Gulf managed to regain the top spot among the industrialized nations, in fact eclipsing the performance of countries like Germany and Japan, which we had all heard about their successes in various areas like education, healthcare, savings, and investment, while the United States seemed to be languishing in a lot of those areas. My response to the "we're number one" ethic was to say, hey, let me explore the reality behind those claims. And so while at The Nation, I began to do a little research, wrote a column there that all of a sudden bloomed into a book. And in fact, there have been a lot of events in the last year that have only, I think, strengthened the "we're number one" ethos and made it even more relevant that I decided to explore this topic. Obviously, the collapse of communism was another opportunity for those who were holding a triumphant view of America's role or place in the world to say, hey, here's another case where America's number one. We beat the communists. We showed that our way of life is the dominant one, the better one, the more effective one. And so, again, it made sense to explore the reality behind the rhetorical claims of being number one. And the interesting thing, David, was that I found, in some ways, that the president and the other triumphalists who were claiming that America was number one were correct. because we are number one, but not the way they'd like us to be.
Yeah.
We are number one in paradoxical, contradictory ways. For example, we are number one in billionaires. We have the most. But at the same time, we're number one in percentage of children living in poverty. We lead in health care spending per capita, but we're also number one in infant mortality among the 19 major industrial countries. So it's contradictions, paradoxes like this, which I juxtapose throughout my book to perhaps shed new light on what it really means to be number one.
Yeah. The various bits of information come together in some remarkable ways. And when you set, in some cases, as you have just given a couple of examples, things next to each other, you just kind of have to shake your head and sort of wonder what it means and how it can be. For example, some of the things you mentioned, if we take healthcare, for example, which is the first section of the book, we are number one in total health spending. When from that you might expect, well, we ought to be pretty healthy, but when you take a look at what we're getting for our money and where we're spending it, we find out that we are also number one, as you mentioned, in infant mortality. We're number one in death of children under five. We're number one in percentage of babies born at low birth weight. We're number one in incidence of cancer in men. We're number 15 in life expectancy. And perhaps not surprising, we're also number one in medical malpractice lawsuits. So it doesn't look like we're getting a lot for the money that we're spending.
Right. In fact, healthcare, I think, has got to be the most crucial area in which the disparities between thinking we're number one and actually our performance are evident. And in fact, some of these contradictory number ones do stand out here. The fact that we could be number one in healthcare spending and at the same time have more of our young babies dying within their first year because of poor prenatal care and lack of access to care once they're born. These are ironies, and at the same time, they're very painful ironies. And the point is, in some ways, this book started because I was poking fun at the quick claims of our President Bush to say we are number one, and in fact, he's unwittingly written the epigraph to the book where he says we are number one and we're going to stay that way. But, when you start putting these things together, it is very difficult to take them at face value without really questioning what our country's all about, that we could have disparities, gaps that are as wide, divisive as they are, in access, in terms of haves versus have-nots, not only in healthcare but in education, obviously in the economy, in terms of income distribution, and they are they're really rife all over.
Another area that's kind of interesting. Well, but there it's really all interesting. But you have a section about attitudes towards sex and sexual behavior.
Uh-huh.
We are number one in the percentage of young people who say that premarital sex should be avoided. We are also number one in teen pregnancy.
Right.
And sort of going along with that, interestingly, we're also number one in ignorance of biology, which may say something about why it is we're number one in teen pregnancy.
Right.
And it's another one of these fascinating things where it seems that what we like to think just doesn't square up with how we act.
Well, David, that is another one of the major themes that emanates from we're number one. It's not just, as we were talking about earlier, with healthcare, there's a disparity between haves and have-nots. The fact that we do have some of the most medically advanced clinics and hospitals, some of the world's best doctors, no doubt, and at the same time, there are people, 37 million Americans, without access to health insurance. We are number one, in fact, among the industrialized countries in percentage of people who don't have health care. So there are the gaps between haves and have-nots, and then there are these gaps that we're alluding to now, which are what I call perception gaps. And these perception gaps do have to do exactly with the disparity between what Americans say and what we actually do. And a very good example of this is the fact that our young people, and this is a surprising one for me since I'm a teacher as well, and I was surprised to learn that among industrialized countries studied in the World Values Survey, which is a decennial public opinion survey, American young people, teenagers, were least likely to say, or in fact most likely to say, that premarital sex should be avoided. And at the same time, as many of us know, we are number one in teen pregnancy. I might add one point to that, talking about teen pregnancy. That is one of those figures, David, that becomes a central point of contention in debates about international competition, about how the United States is doing relative to other countries in healthcare. And in fact, when those issues are often debated in Congress, one thing they say is, well, you know, teen pregnancy in this country is probably higher than teen pregnancy in countries like France, Germany, Japan, etc., because of what conservatives might call the quote-unquote urban problem. And I often think that's an interesting veiled way of trying to say, isn't this really the fault of inner-city minorities, blacks and Hispanics largely? And there's an interesting thing that we can see with teen pregnancy, and I try to do this throughout the book to counter the claims that I know many will make to any international comparisons. What I do is essentially break down the teen pregnancy rates for the United States generally and the white rate only. And in fact, the white teenage pregnancy rate is higher than that of all other industrialized nations in and of itself. And the reason I do that is because I do know that when these debates do take place in congressional hearings and things like that, the automatic response of, again, I think it's largely of conservatives, is to say you can't really compare the U.S. with a country like Japan or a country like Canada or Germany or Britain or France in some of these indicators because we have been, shall we say, a place of ingathering.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is Andrew Shapiro. He is a staff member of The Nation. He also teaches social studies and English at the Dalton School in New York, and he's the author of a recent book entitled We're Number One, Where America Stands and Falls in the New World Order. Vintage is the publisher, and it is available in paperback if you'd like to read it. We do have a caller we'll talk to in a second here. Other folks are welcome into the conversation, 333-WILL. Here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. That's for anybody, anywhere you can hear us, you can use that number. And we have somebody here on that line, so we'll talk with them. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you feel that a lot of our shortcomings are due to the fact that the country has gone to a service economy rather than an industrial manufacturing country?
Well, indeed, I think a lot of the problems do have to do with the fact that we have become a service economy. We have more service employees per capita, I do believe, than almost any industrialized nation. But I don't think that is the one factor, I think, that has distinguishes the United States from others because, in fact, most industrial nations are moving away from industrial bases to service bases. In fact, many of the others are as well, maybe not as rapidly as the United States. But let me point out to you some other disparities that come out of my economy chapter that may be illuminating for you. To begin with, as we said at the top of the program, we do the most maybe easy one to read is we are number one in billionaires, and we also have the largest percentage of children and elderly people living in poverty, which is truly astounding. In fact, one out of five young people in the United States lives in poverty, one out of ten among the elderly. At the same time, let's look at another one in terms of our spending priorities. We lead in defense spending, and of course, many Americans would say, well, that's because we're the largest country. But again, I should remind listeners that that is per capita, or I should say, in fact, a percentage of central government expenditures and all of the data, and where number one is in relative terms, relative to the size of the population or the overall government size. And so we are number one in defense spending. At the same time, relative to central government expenditures, we are last among the industrial nations in spending on the poor, the disabled, and the aged. And those are services for housing, welfare, social services, things like that. And I would say it's not just a matter then of our industrial versus service base, but our spending priorities in terms of also our income distribution. You know, we are still, the United States is still the wealthiest nation on earth in terms of per capita gross domestic product. We are the wealthiest, richest, we have the most buying power, and we do lead in private consumption. But look at the other side of it. Our income distribution is the most inequitable of the industrialized nations. In fact, the top 20%, the ratio of what the top 20% of income earners to the lowest 20% of income earners makes is larger. That ratio is larger in this country. That is, the gap between those haves and have-nots larger here in the U.S. than it is anywhere.
Yeah, but a service economy is low wages as a rule. The biggest majority of those people are only part-time workers, so they never accumulate any wealth. Eventually, when they retire, the taxpayers are going to take care of them because they have nothing saved.
I agree that part-time work and the fact that low wages are part of a service economy by nature are definitely problems. But I don't think that we're going to be able to reverse that process and move back to a unifocular industrialized base, because that seems to be the way that economies all throughout the world, developed economies, are moving. So
in the end, we're all going to be poorer, right?
Well, you know, let's look at the successes of some other nations. One of the strategies that I'm trying to advocate by writing this book, in fact, you know, we'll jump the gun here a little bit, but one of the conclusions, in fact, that I would like readers of the book to take away is not only that because the United States is number one in a lot of compromising ways, do we need to work on domestic issues as opposed to our role as the world's policeman, which I think we've been pursuing for too long. But I also think that we need to break out of a myopic mindset that sees the United States in competition so much with nations like Germany and Japan. We need to be a little bit more humble. We need to be willing to share some of the successes that we have had in education, technology, industry, healthcare. And we need to be humble enough to learn from other countries like Japan and Germany. Look at the savings and investment rates, a clear example where somehow the United States has gone awry. Maybe we're just overly consumptive, or we're not investing in the right places. But our investing and savings rates, again, relative to our GDP, are the lowest in the industrialized world. And Japan and Germany are saving 2-3 times what we're saving. That's an example where perhaps if we did not have such an adversarial relationship in terms of international competition and always trying to be better than the other nations, we could work more cooperatively together in organizations like the UN, the OECD, and the G7 towards a higher standard of living for all of these industrialized nations and, in fact, all countries around the world.
The younger people in Japan and Germany are getting more like our people over here that were 20 years ago. So their savings rate is actually coming down compared to what it was 10 years ago.
Is that right? I haven't seen breakdowns between young and old.
That's true.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller.
Some other interesting things. When we start talking about people's their inner life, I suppose, it seems that we emerge as a nation that at least thinks a lot about the larger questions. Maybe we'll put it that way. It is interesting to observe that the United States is number one among the major industrial nations in belief in God, the devil, heaven, and hell. We're also number one in thinking about the meaning of life, and we're number one in thinking about death. Now, what does that tell you?
Those are a set of peculiar ones, and those come from the World Value Survey, the international public opinion survey I was mentioning earlier. And I do think those are quite telling. You know, the United States, in many ways, is still a very traditional country, wed to the concept of religion, even while being plagued by fragmented families. We are number one, first of all, in marriage. We have the highest marriage rate, the highest divorce rate as well. But you know, here's the traditional side of things, David. We are still number one among the industrialized nations in believing in marriage and saying that marriage is still a viable institution. So the question is, are we just not living up to our expectations, or are we fooling ourselves there?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with belief in God. I make a juxtaposition later in the book that we are number one in belief in God, and that's an interesting thing. In fact, 98% of Americans say they believe in God. At the same time, we're number one in murder. We've got the highest murder rate, a rate double that of Germany, 4 times that of Japan. And the question is, well, a lot of people stop me there and say, wait a minute, you're trying to juxtapose being number one in belief in God and number one in murder. Are you saying that there's a direct relationship, a correlation between the two? My response is there may not be a direct relationship, but it is more illuminating to put these two numbers together, because you consider for a moment the United States may be the most devout and the most sinful nation on earth all at once. And that's where you start to see, I think, some of the real ironies or even the disturbing elements of life in America today.
Mm.
Now, one of the interesting things about belief in religion, God, etc., that you mentioned, in the United States does lead in all of these categories, belief in God, belief in the devil, heaven, and hell. It's quite interesting to note, I think, that all industrialized nations, citizens in all industrialized nations, when polled, do say that they believe more in God and in heaven than in the devil and hell. So it seems that we all have a little bit of positive or wishful thinking in terms of the afterlife.
Yeah. Just going back to something you were talking about before, I think that's, I'm sure people make that point with you a lot, that there are all sorts of ways that we could put these statistics together and line them up that would imply relationships. And then that question then becomes, well, is that really, you know, you take two things and sit them next to each other, that we are both, we are number one in both marriage and divorce, that we are number one in murder, we're number one in belief in God. Does that really, you know, then you have to say, well, so what? I mean, what is the relationship between those things other than the fact that, well, they're both there?
Right. Well, I think part of the response may be so what, but I think part of the response may lead people to think a little bit about what it means to be number one in some of those areas. And, you know, I guess what I could say, my macro answer, David, is that in a way what this entire book is one single argument in that I'm trying to critique or even, dare I say, deconstruct the notion of being number one, of claiming to be number one. I'm trying to show that me-firstism or America-firstism is a bankrupt concept. And the reason it's a bankrupt concept is because we are number one, but in different ways, in good ways, in bad ways, and even ugly ways. Being number one in murder is truly an ugly number one. So, essentially, what I'm saying then is putting these things together, I do believe, makes them more illuminating, also shows in some ways, though, that to claim to be number one is such a dangerous thing because it can so easily slip into arrogance and hubris and blind faith and a lack of critical thinking that I'm asking people to juxtapose these things for that very reason so that they will look at them more closely. Let me give you another good example of that kind of juxtaposition. The United States has the highest handgun death rate of any country, and obviously handguns have been a contentious issue in recent years, and there's been a lot of lobbying from both sides, the handgun lobby, I should say the anti-gun lobby and the NRA, at loggerheads over whether we're going to have a 7-day waiting period, et cetera. And obviously many of the people who are advocating gun control point to the fact that we are number one in handgun deaths as a reason why we should indeed have more strict controls on handguns. And in fact, if you look at other countries, some of the other Western European nations have much stricter controls. Britain, you can't even get your hands on a gun, practically. What I juxtapose that statistic with, and we're number one, is the fact that the United States is also number one in capital punishment. Now, that's an interesting one, and people often say, wait a minute, what are you saying there? Well, the point is, handgun death, you know, some people say it's inevitable. You know, even if we impose new strictures on gun control, on purchasing guns and the waiting periods, etc., criminals will still have access to guns in the long run. But let's look at capital punishment, and that's an area where we're number one. A lot of people don't think about that. In fact, the United States is the only Western industrial nation that still uses the death penalty regularly. The only other comparable country which uses it at all ever is Japan, and they use it only, I think, one or two times a year in very extreme abnormal cases. And my point there is that the seeming types of violence that we point to as indicative of the culture of violence that we are experiencing right now, perhaps exemplified best by the Rodney King uprising in Los Angeles in recent months, goes on both sides. And it's about violence that we can prevent. It's about violence that we can work against in terms of taking guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't get them. It's also about things like the death penalty, which to many of us, I think, you know, 3/4 of Americans say they support the death penalty. I'm trying to get people to think about what that means, what it means to be number one in capital punishment, and whether that is a number one that Americans should be proud of or should, in fact, re-examine.
Mm. Oh, well, our guest this morning is Andrew Shapiro, and we have a caller here we'll talk with in just a second. Our guest this morning, Andrew Shapiro, is a staff member of The Nation. He's also a teacher of social studies and English at the Dalton School in New York and is the author of a book that we have been talking about. The book is entitled We're Number One. Here's a caller on our toll-free line to talk with. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Shapiro. Listen, you've told us everything that the American people know about. I mean, we know all these things. Now, how about giving us a remedy? A remedy how we can do away with this?
Well, I wish that there were a simple remedy, and you know, you point to an interesting issue which I've confronted, in fact, since the beginning of my work on this book, and that is, I set out when I did this to show how America really stacks up against the other industrialized countries in everything from education to healthcare, the economy, politics, crime, and the environment. There are a lot of shocking things in here, and I don't think that everybody is aware of them. I'll give you a couple of examples. The fact that we are, as I said earlier, last in spending on the poor, the disabled, and the aged. The fact that while we lead in watching television, we are last in book titles, new book titles published per capita. So there are a lot of pieces of information here that I think would be new to you. What I might say in terms of the relationship between, you know, the information that's in here and the policy prescriptions that you might be asking for, my conscious decision when I began the project was to stay away from making those sorts of recommendations, because I felt that you would have to be an expert in each and every one of these areas to be able to do that responsibly. So in fact, in contradiction to that, what I've said at the beginning of the book is I will hope that this book will spark debate, that it will lead the policy analysts in legislatures, in governor's office, mayor's offices, even the federal government, to question some of the priorities that they have made, some of the decisions they've made, and to look forward in terms of improving ourselves in a lot of these areas. In terms of citizen involvement, let me tell you how I think readers can get involved. I will hope, I hope that by reading this book, citizens, especially in a political election year, and it's really no coincidence that the book is coming out in this year, because I think that in many ways it can become a citizen's hand guide, and I think for many people I've already heard from, it's become a citizen's hand guide, allowing them to match up against what the candidates say in all these appearances on television and even in their written platforms, which I don't think anyone reads anymore, but in those ways as well, to match up what those candidates are saying to actually how the United States is doing. And that means that I hope that citizens can use this book, we're number one, to hold their politicians accountable, to say to George Bush, you say that we're number one, you say that the United States is an infallible nation, the greatest, the strongest, he's even said that we're the kindest nation on earth. That's really peculiar to me. I hope that people will hold him accountable using some of the information here and saying to him, how can we be the kindest nation on earth when we have 37 million Americans who don't have health care? How can we be the kindest nation on earth when our knowledge of math and science among our young people is the lowest? How can we be the kindest nation on earth when we have more poor, elderly, and young people than any industrialized country in the world? The same thing for the other candidates. Say to Ross Perot, if you're going to be the president, what are you going to do about the fact that we are number one in bankers per capita, but we're also number one in poor bank performance? What are you going to do about the fact that our executive salaries are the highest in the world? That is, our CEOs make more than CEOs in any industrialized nation. That's about $750,000 here compared to just half that in Japan. And at the same time, we're number one in inequality of pay. That's the gap between the lowest and the highest paid worker. That gap is larger in this country than in any industrialized nation, 25 times here compared again to Japan at just 11 times. So ask Ross Perot those questions. And for Bill Clinton, you might ask on the environment, since many have assailed his environmental record in Arkansas, what about the fact that the United States is number one in garbage per capita, almost a ton of garbage per person each year, and on the other side, we are only 14th in recycling. So, again, my summary answer is it's about empowerment, it's about information and access to that information. You know, all of this data comes from public sources and is available to people. It's just too hard to find because the manuals are expensive, they are cumbersome, unreadable even. I tried to pull them all together so that you would have one source of information, again, by which you could really hold politicians accountable at all levels of government. Mm.
There is one, just to pull out, though, another of the statistics that you offered that is that touches on politics and that is a little bit discouraging. We are number one in the percentage of the population who say they take an active interest in politics, but we're last in voter turnout.
That's right, David, and that's another one of those perception gaps we were mentioning earlier. And it's sometimes hard to believe. What is it about the American character that leads us to be so off base in terms of how we think of ourselves and how we actually are. The fact that we could lead in percentage of all people, who say that they take an active interest in politics, and that means registering voters or working for a candidate actively, and yet our voter turnout rate is lowest in the industrialized world. In fact, only half of eligible voters will probably come out this November. There are some reasons why, and one of the reasons is because voter registration policies in this country are so Byzantine, in fact, more complicated than I think in almost any industrialized nation, some of which actually require, most of which I think require their citizens to register to vote, and some of which even require them to actually vote on election days.
You know, we've given several examples of this kind of gap between what we say and what we do, our this belief behavior gap. I wonder if in the process of looking at the information that you did, you have some feeling for whether there are other countries that show that degree of contradiction. Is that unique to the United States, or is that more common?
Well, this is one of the areas that I am most interested in. It's at this point, I can only answer speculatively, but I have some figures that back it up to indeed show, David, that this is in some ways a unique American phenomenon.
So we're number one in contradictions.
We are number one in hypocrisy, perhaps. Number one in thinking we're number one when we're not. I'll give you an example in terms of math scores among young people. The United States, in a survey of six or seven countries conducted by ETS, our young people were most likely to say that they were good at mathematics. And at the same time, in the test that was conducted, our students came in dead last. And if you look at the students who did the best in terms of performance in that test, it was the South Koreans. And in the previous question, when asked, are you good at math, South Koreans were least likely to say they were good at math. So there's something to learn there. It was almost an inverse relationship between the humility of the students and their performance. That is, the students who were the most humble did the best. The students who were least humble, the American kids, did the worst. And I think there's a value for all of us to learn there, and that is that the sort of arrogance and pride and hubris that would lead us to so quickly jump and say, we are number one, we are the best, we are infallible, is a dangerous thing. It's a value that we probably have to examine closely and, I would hope, discard. And we do need to look at and even consider working towards the humility that other countries have, even when they are performing as well as, say, these South Korean young people were on their math test. They were still humble about their abilities.
Yeah. We have some other callers. Again, someone on our toll-free line. Hello?
Yeah, Mr. Shapiro.
Hi.
Listen, I have a remedy.
Okay.
Clean sweep, fore and aft. Vote for Peru.
Vote for Peru?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well,
get rid of everybody. I was the guy before you. I couldn't even get a question into you. Does your kids ever ask you a question at school?
Sure.
How do they interrupt you?
Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe on radio it's a little different.
Listen, teach them. Don't talk them to death.
All right, thanks. Well, the caller says vote for Perot. I mean, that's
one vote for Perot
answer, but we'll see. You know, interestingly enough, I mean, a lot of people have been saying that as I've been talking on radio shows throughout the country. People have called in and said, you know, maybe that's the answer to this. I'm not sure, but I have been talking to people in different camps about the ways in which our candidate should respond. You know, Paul Kennedy, who is the author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers and a historian at Yale, mm-hmm. His comment on the book, which is on the cover, is all the presidential candidates should be asked to respond to it. So maybe the caller's right. I'm still waiting to hear from them, though.
Let's go on. So we have a caller on line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling. Earlier you talked about the murder rate in this country, and you said it was very high and compared it to countries such as England. I'm wondering if you could compare it to some other countries that have much lower rates even than England, namely Switzerland and Israel.
The murder rate? Sure. Our murder rate is, we have more than 20,000 murders each year mm-hmm. in the United States, which is really a huge number. It's higher, in fact, than any other industrialized countries. The per capita rate is 9.4 per 100,000. Mm-hmm. The rate in, let's say you asked about Switzerland, was that right?
Yeah.
2.3 per 100,000 in Switzerland, which is about three or four times less. And Israel, I don't have the figures for offhand, although I think I do have handgun death figures for Israel. Yeah, I do, in fact. And their figures for handgun deaths, let's see, ours are 38 per million, and theirs is 6 per million. So again, that's about 6 times less.
Okay, I guess the point of my question is, when talking about England, you talked about how a good part of this could be our availability of handguns.
Right.
Whereas Switzerland and Israel are probably the two most heavily armed countries in the Western world. I was wondering.
In fact, these are I know exactly where you're coming from because having studied the gun control issue to some degree, this is an argument that's used by the NRA all the time. In fact, in their lobbying efforts, how come if Switzerland and Israel have more guns per capita than the U.S., why in fact is our murder rate with guns even higher, and would it matter if we ban guns, etc.? But let me point you to another area of my book. In fact, it talks about guns per capita. We are number one in gun ownership, and in fact, the numbers that I have from various international sources that come out of the Netherlands show that, in fact, the percentage of households with handguns in the United States is higher than it is in Switzerland. More than 200 million guns in this country. That's enough to arm every single adult in this country with a gun. 28.6% of our households have handguns. Only 14%, according to my sources, have handguns. 14% of households in Switzerland have handguns. Israel, I don't have the similar figures for, but you know the difference there may be that since everybody goes through the army, having a gun is sort of like having a television or radio around your house. It's not as big a deal, and I think they may be therefore more responsible with handguns.
I have to talk about your statistics with Switzerland. Every man between the ages of 18 and 65 in Switzerland is required to keep a rifle and ammunition in his house so he can be called up very quickly by the militia.
But that's a rifle. I'm talking about handguns.
Right. However, for domestic violence, the statistics on whether or not you're more likely to use a rifle or a handgun are practically nil. It doesn't really matter.
I'm talking about gun control. We're mostly talking about handgun control. Rifles usually aren't as big a problem when it comes to street crime, murders, things like that.
Most of these murders are not street crime. Most of these murders are domestic.
A lot of them are. That's true.
So if you've eliminated all of our street crime, we still have more murders than these people would.
Probably.
And if you look at Japan, another very low murder rate country, the Japanese community in this country has a lower murder rate among itself than the Japanese country does, than you know Japan as a whole does.
Uh-huh.
Now, again, you can't argue that it's because the Japanese over here have even less access to firearms. That would be a silly thing. Firearms are very strictly regulated in Japan.
So what do you think the answer is?
I guess it just seems that the predominant thing would more be cultural than the availability of firearms.
Right. I don't in fact come out, as I was telling a caller earlier, I try to avoid all policy prescriptions in the book, and I don't come out on one side or the other of the handgun issue, although I am strongly, on a personal level, in favor of handgun control. I can see no reason to not have a 7-day waiting period. I don't think that any of our rights as enumerated in the Bill of Rights will be compromised if we had that kind of policy. But, you know, you talk about a cultural factor that may be responsible for the violence in this country, and it may not just be the access to handguns.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you a set of statistics that is interesting in that sense. In fact, I juxtapose this with the gun ownership figures I was telling you about earlier.
Okay.
The United States is also number one in percentage of people who believe that killing in self-defense can always be justified.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an interesting one. In fact, 84% of Americans polled say that killing in self-defense can be justified sometimes or always.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the highest percentage of any of the countries for which data is available.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in Japan, if you want to compare it to Japan, only 38% of people in that country say that self-defense killing is justifiable. So, I mean, that may, again, be one reason. I mean, whether it's self-defense or the person committing the crime thinks it's self-defense,
mm-hmm.
We are living with a culture that is used to having guns around, that doesn't, I don't think, recognize the severity of our crime rate. It's not just murder. We have the highest robbery rate, the highest rate of rape, and that's widely underreported, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Many studies have shown that the Justice Department's rape figures are probably 10 times too low.
Mm-hmm.
We have the highest rate of victimization. That's all crimes reported. American citizens are more likely to be the victim of a crime than are any other citizen in the world.
And, mm-hmm.
So really there's a composite picture of the violent country that we're living in right now, and even I add in the fact in the end there that we are number one in lawyers in litigation, which I think for some people is as scary as our spiraling crime rate. So.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the call.
We have somebody else here. Let's go to a toll-free line. Hello.
What country is top in book titles per capita?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked that. Denmark leads in that category, and in fact, there's an interesting, the gap there is just unbelievable. The United States publishes 50,000 new book titles each year, which seems like a lot, and who's going to be able to read that many books? No one, really. But if you talk about it in per capita terms, again, and this is an interesting way of measuring our literacy or our interest in books, we only publish 2 per 10,000 people. That's how it comes out when you talk about it in per capita terms. Denmark publishes 22 books per 10,000 people,
okay.
So that's 11 times as many.
Now, how does that statistic go when you break it down into Harlequin-type novels?
That's a good question, too. And, in fact, I was thinking the exact same thing when I started doing research on my book. And so I, in fact, tried to come up with an indicator which I thought would measure, if I take your point correctly, the seriousness of the books we're reading. Is that what you mean?
Quick read, a book that, takes a little while, aside from the kind you can zip through in an hour.
Well, here's what I did. What I was able to find, and these are statistics that come from UNESCO, the United Nations organization that tracks cultural and education indicators. What I measured was philosophy titles published per capita because I thought that would be an interesting way of measuring, let's say, the seriousness of what we publish. And again, the United States comes out last in dissemination of what I call deep thinking. We publish fewer philosophy titles per capita than any industrialized nation, only 3 titles per million people each year. Denmark, again, the leader, publishes 80 philosophy books per million people each year. So thank you very much for calling in.
Very philosophical. I'm going to ask some other questions.
Sure.
I don't know. That seems like an awful lot of philosophy.
Doesn't it?
And then, it seems to me that most of the books that, and even your own book, in a way, is kind of a philosophy book, in the sense that...
Thanks. I'll take that as a compliment.
Well, I do. The self-help books and things that sort of flood our market are a type of philosophy, in the sense of trying to grow some kind of a philosophy that, permits people to do better.
Let me mention something else to you while you're on the line, because a lot of people ask me, specifically with something like the book titles per capita, how do you get this information? I was mentioning to you that this comes from UNESCO. All the data that's in We're Number One comes from sources just like that, from the United Nations and its agencies, things like the World Health Organization, the World Bank, the IMF, the OECD, and a lot of people question, what are the sources of these? And people should realize that these are the establishment's figures.
No, I'm not questioning you at all. I'll move on to another. I've got a couple more questions here, since time is running short. And
sure.
Others listening, waiting to get on.
Okay.
In how many nations is, a 30-channel cable system available on TV?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how many nations have access to that many cable channels. Cable is spreading throughout the world, but the United States, I'm sure, leads in that area.
Most nations just have like 4 or 5?
We are number one. We have the most televisions per capita in the U.S., the most radios, which is lucky for you since you're listening in. We are also number one in time spent. We spend 29 hours a week on average watching television.
Well, I know that as our cable system keeps adding channels, the latest is CNBC, which is, a talk channel and information channel. And you run short of time to try and see all the things, hear all the things you'd like to hear. Another question, where does the United States rank in amount of money spent per prisoner in the prison system?
Well, that's a little bit, I had some difficulty trying to track that one down. I did try to. What I can tell you about incarceration in this country is that we lead in number of prisoners, not only in absolute terms. In fact, we have more people behind bars in this country than there are people living in the city of San Francisco, which is a pretty awesome figure, more than a million people. And in per capita terms, it's the highest of any country, including South Africa, including the former Soviet Union. In fact, we have more black males imprisoned in this country than does South Africa. So that's what I can tell you in terms of incarceration. I also know that spending figures cross nationally are very difficult to come by.
Because I know that the costs are, and I'm not a parotista, but one of the things that Mr. Perot has talked about is he was talking, about $85,000 prison cells that he knew people having $85,000, and the fact that it costs more to keep somebody in prison than to send them to Harvard.
Well, I think that number's, that's probably the extreme. I think the average is somewhere probably closer to 30,000, maybe 50,000 in bigger states. But it is very high, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was higher in this country than in others.
One other quick question.
Sure.
Another subject. I was surprised here the other day somebody said that 30% of the children born in France are illegitimate. Where does the United States rank in rate of illegitimacy, percentage of illegitimate children?
Well, illegitimacy I'm not sure about. I do know that there are, in fact, some of the Scandinavian countries also, there are many single mothers who have children born out of wedlock. But the statistics I have on single-parent families show that the United States, in fact, does have the highest rate of single-parent families. So I'm not familiar with that France statistic you were talking about.
You know, there's one other thing about statistics. I mean, Mr. Inge said you can sort of cut them the way you want them, and it's true, or line them up, but you can cut them also. The one that I find kind of ridiculous is the teenage pregnancy statistic. I think there is a world of difference between a young woman of 18 or 19 becoming pregnant and a girl of 13 or 14 being pregnant. So to lump them together is, I think,
rather absurd. It's not 13 or 14. My numbers are 15 to 19. And I think that the point is, if you're using the same category, 15 to 19, in every country, you're likely to get at least a fair comparison across those nations. You do make an interesting point, though, about reliability of statistics, and one of my big caveats in my author's note at the beginning of Where Number One has to do with the fact that I did not begin this project as a statistician. I began this project as a curious citizen who was listening to the triumphalism of our president and other politicians and saying, wait a minute, what do you mean we're number one? Let me try to examine this a little more closely. And so I do believe that there are ways in which statistics can be put together to tell different kinds of stories. What I could tell you is that while there are single numbers or single facts or number ones in my book that may change from year to year or that you may dispute the methodological viability of, overall there's a preponderance of evidence in Where Number One that's pretty formidable, if not irrefutable, that the United States has got to focus on our domestic situation, that our triumphant attitude towards our role in world affairs has got to come down to earth, that we need a reality check, and I think this can be it.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there because we're at the end of our time. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Sure. Thank you, David.
Our guest, Andrew Shapiro, he's a staff member of The Nation. His book, if you would like to read it, is We're Number One, published by Vintage.